Marcus Aurelius might be one of the most widely read philosophers in the Western world today. His Meditations is incredibly popular, and quotes from it adorn many a Twitter header or a Goodreads account. Having said that, I think that Marcus sometimes suffers from this enormous success, as the soundbites slowly begin to replace the man himself. Because, as I will argue, Marcus Aurelius is a surprisingly complex and multifaceted thinker, and I think we have much to learn from him. So today, I just want to explore a few of those interesting themes in his work, with the aid of this wonderful book, The Cambridge Companion to Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, which is a collection of essays by top scholars on the subject of the Meditations, all compiled by John Sellars, who I am just generally a massive fan of. Now, obviously, this video is not a complete guide, nor is it a substitute for reading the Meditations for yourself. It's just some observations that, hopefully, you will find interesting. And let's begin with the framework that bubbles in the background of Marcus's whole text. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. 1. Marcus the Stoic. Marcus Aurelius is known today as a Stoic thinker, and although I'm sure the outlines of Stoicism are probably familiar to many of you, it is worth recapping this in particular connection with Marcus Aurelius, as it's just sort of basically impossible to talk about the Meditations in general without this pre-established. But we'll also be noting where Marcus places special emphasis on particular aspects of Stoic teaching, and thus what makes the Meditations distinctive, even in this respect. Now, just reading the Meditations, you would be forgiven for thinking that Marcus Aurelius had little, if any, time for abstract philosophical ideas. Take, for instance, this line in Book 1, where he says that he is grateful that, for all my love of philosophy, I did not fall in with any sophist or devote my time to the analysis of literature or logic or busy myself with cosmic speculation. Quotes like these and the oft-repeated line, "Waste no more time arguing what a good man should be one," have left the impression for many that Aurelius thought that any kind of philosophy that was not immediately and straightforwardly concerned with action was a mistake and a waste of time. But I would argue that a closer reading of the text reveals that while Marcus was certainly quite skeptical of excessive rumination and thought without any possible connection to action, this is evidently not how he saw things like Stoic physics, or what we probably call Stoic metaphysics in today's philosophical terminology. To simplify things somewhat, the Stoics very broadly believed that the universe was fatalistic, and that it wasn't just fatalistic, but that things were preordained for the best health of the universe overall. Some have referred to this as a pantheist position, though, like a lot of things, this has been disputed. The main thing to bear in mind here is that in classic Stoicism, everything is determined, but also everything that is determined is also ultimately serving some higher purpose or goal, known as the universe's logos. Stoic metaphysics is obviously much more complex than this, but this will just have to suffice for now and for the sake of this video. This view underlies the ethical Stoic acceptance of the things that happen to them, even the seemingly unpleasant things, as both necessary and good, or as they might put it, in accordance with nature. This is obviously an incredibly different view of the universe than many of us have today. We tend to think that everything that happens is not necessarily for the best, and that things don't always happen because of divine providence, but because of totally non-teleological mechanistic forces. But despite his apparent lack of time for abstract cosmological issues, Aurelius clearly does think that this Stoic view of the universe is both probably true and worthwhile to think about and reflect upon. For instance, take the following. Remember how long you've been putting this off. It is high time now for you to understand that the universe of which you are a part, and the governor of that universe of whom you constitute an emanation, and that there is a limit circumscribed to your time. If you do not use it to clear away your clouds, it will be gone, and you will be gone, and the opportunity will not return. We can see here the direct connection between Marcus's Stoic physics and the particular ethical outcomes that he is striving for. Here, the teleological and rational structure of the universe allows Marcus to consider his own life as a gift from the governor of that universe, and this attitude is, in turn, used to shake him into action. But before moving on, if you want to achieve an entirely different kind of accuracy about the world around you, then I recommend you check out today's sponsor, Ground News. Ground News is a website and app that gathers related articles from thousands of sources around the world in one place, so you can compare how different outlets cover the same story. Every story comes with a clear breakdown of the political bias, factuality, ownership, and headlines of the reporting sources, with ratings backed by independent news monitoring organizations. Ground News are very kindly offering anyone who uses my link or scans my QR code 40% off their Vantage plan as a special deal, so I highly encourage you to snap this up. For instance, let's see how left and right-wing publications differed on their reporting on the recent deal reached between Cornell University and the Trump administration. Whereas left-wing sources framed this in negative terms, saying that the administration had withheld funds, right-wing sources emphasize the perceived responsibility of the university and generally frame things in a more positive manner. I especially like the Blind Spots feed, which highlights stories that are disproportionately covered by the left or the right. This feed helps readers step into the other side's news reality and understand the different narratives that can shape their beliefs, such as left-wing sources missing the Department of Justice pursuing grand jury subpoenas for the former CIA director John Brennan, or right-wing sources missing Serbia passing a special bill to allow Trump's son-in-law to build a luxury compound. I just don't have a lot of time to keep up with the news, and certainly not to examine every article I read for bias. So, receiving my Ground News roundup at the end of every day means I can get a variety of news opinions, learn which sources are trustworthy, and just generally make the world less of a bewildering mess. Ground News is giving my viewers 40% off their unlimited access Vantage plan. They've genuinely become my go-to news source, and I sincerely hope that you'll check them out. But anyway, back to the video. However, more often this teleological structure is used to comfort Aurelius in a time of trouble. For example, the nature of the whole set itself to create a universe. So now, either everything that comes into being springs from that as logical consequence, or else even the primary aims to which the directing mind of the universe sets its own impulse are irrational. Reminding yourself of this will help you to face much with greater tranquility. Here, that same Stoic cosmology is used to allow Marcus to accept the events that are happening to him. There is a clear link between a metaphysical idea and an ethical or character-building one. So, all of this is to say, I think we should be really quite skeptical of the presentation often given of Aurelius that he had no time for anything theoretical. I think it would make a bit more sense to say that he had no time for the merely theoretical, but also that he seems to refuse to draw a sharp line between theory and practice. And in context, this makes an awful lot of sense. Even for the ancient world, the Stoics tied their ethics, their physics, and their logic and epistemology rather closely together. We can see this reflected in Zeno, the founder of Stoicism, who reduced the four cardinal Stoic virtues, courage, temperance, justice, and wisdom, to reflections of just one virtue, wisdom itself. And that wisdom included having an accurate view of the world's logos. This in turn meant that physics, that is, the structure of the world, and logic, the means to investigate the world, were inextricably tied up with ethics. Stoics often used images to make this point, such as Apollodorus talking of philosophy as analogous to a body, with physics corresponding to the soul, ethics to the flesh, and logic to the bones and sinews. Although it is fair to say that Marcus, like a lot of Roman or imperial Stoics, places more emphasis on the ethical component, I don't think we should just consider him as an ethical or merely self-improvement style author. He clearly bases any ethical ideas from classic Stoic starting points. Marcus also reflects the Stoic skepticism about impulses, which he defines along the lines of initial first impressions that are sort of automatically created for you when you perceive something. So if you learnt that a friend had insulted you behind your back, then impulse would refer to the immediate angry reaction that you instinctively responded with. And this actually marks an interesting difference between much of imperial and much of Hellenic Stoicism, since imperial Stoics paid much more attention to this definition of impulse. Marcus also reflects Orthodox Stoic teaching by considering our impulses and generally our distress with the world as stemming from faulty judgments made on the basis of our sense perceptions, but importantly, added to those sense perceptions. To quote Marcus directly, "Things of themselves cannot touch the soul at all. They have no entry to the soul and cannot turn or move it. The soul alone turns and moves itself, making all externals presented to it cohere with the judgments it thinks worthy of itself." As pointed out by Benjamin Harriman, here he follows the example of previous imperial Stoics like Seneca. In fact, the particular emphases that Aurelius puts on aspects of Stoic teachings are perhaps the most interesting part of him as a Stoic thinker. For example, in the same essay, Harriman also points out that Marcus straddles a very interesting divide within Stoic ethics. So, in what we might call Orthodox Stoicism, virtue is considered the sole good and it is also considered sufficient for happiness, but in addition to this, there is a framework of preferred indifference and dispreferred indifference. These are things that aren't considered good or bad in themselves, but nonetheless can be rationally desired or avoided by Stoic practitioners, if that makes sense. So, a classic dispreferred indifferent is death. Stoics don't think that death is bad in itself, since to die is in accordance with nature, but nonetheless, they think that it is okay to have an interest in avoiding it. Likewise, something like wealth is not good in itself, because only virtue is, but Orthodox Stoics considered it a preferred indifference. This idea of indifference has its origins in the founder of Stoicism, that Zeno we were talking about earlier, but was also fully embraced by his successor, Cleanthes. And also, be aware that the debates about what exactly indifference are and what they consist in does continue to be a bit of a minor interpretive battleground, so I've kind of simplified things here. However, there was an unorthodox Stoic named Aristo who rejected this idea of preferred and dispreferred indifference, as well as quite a lot of other mainstream Stoic metaphysics and logic. He thought instead that we should be totally indifferent to everything except virtue and vice, and so the preferred and dispreferred distinction just doesn't make any odds to Aristo. And, as Harriman points out, Marcus Aurelius sometimes drifts surprisingly close to this second Aristoian view, as when he encourages himself to be indifferent towards everything, save for virtue and vice, that is reflecting Aristo's viewpoints, and this is something that he writes at points in the Meditations. But at other points, Marcus is much more prone to preferring things apart from virtue and vice. He often expresses a preference for good governance and desiring healthy children and the ability to help his friends. So, little tensions like this suggest that Aurelius is not just some parroting pupil of the Stoic thoughts he has heard or read before. He is keen to build on that foundation and to sometimes question the pre-existing orthodoxy. In another paper by Julia Weilberger, she highlights just how pro-social Marcus is compared to other Stoic philosophers. Take this passage, for example. "When universal nature has constituted rational creatures for the sake of each other, to benefit one another as deserved, but never to do harm, anyone contravening her will is clearly guilty of sin against the oldest of the gods, because universal nature is the nature of ultimate reality to which all present existence is related." Here, Marcus draws a direct connection between the goodness of nature and the duty of people in the world to aid one another. Elsewhere, he directly states that nature is, in a sense, a community of all rationality and thus a community of all people as well. Contrary to the popular perception of a Stoic as a solitary monk-like figure, Aurelius repeatedly condemns a retreat from public life, saying that although we can withdraw into ourselves and into our own minds from time to time, the genuine fulfillment of our natures can only be found in our relationships and our duties towards others. So, To clarify, this is not unprecedented in Stoicism at all, which has quite often placed an emphasis on duty, but it is remarkable just how much Marcus focuses on it, and how this coheres with his social background as an emperor and thus as a governor and leader, while Berger calls it distinctive of Marcus's approach. Aurelius probably places so much emphasis on social life and its connection to Stoic philosophy because it is his job to govern one of the largest empires of the ancient world. Likewise, the writings of Epictetus, a former slave, continually come back to freedom and how the Stoic can be mentally free even in chains. So you can certainly see how Epictetus's background has informed the particular emphases that he places on Stoic philosophy. And I do like to think of these particular Stoic thinkers as a bit like prisons. They take those same fundamental ideas of Stoicism, but filter and reflect them through the particular concerns of their own background and position and place in society. There are, of course, many other aspects to Marcus's Stoicism that we could discuss here, but in some ways, it's even more interesting to touch upon some of his less straightforwardly Stoic influences. 2. Marcus the Eclectic. When we're looking back on historical thinkers, it's very easy to start sorting them into camps and just be done with things. We put them in the Platonist box, or the Scholastic box, or the Stoic box, or the Liberal box, and then see their entire body of work just through that lens. Marcus Aurelius, as we would often read him, is no different. We just call him a Stoic and then call it a day. But one of my favourite parts of the Meditations is the way that Marcus Aurelius draws upon a range of different philosophical traditions in order to make particular points. This is not to say that he is not a Stoic. Stoicism is undoubtedly the tradition that best characterizes his overall thoughts and their overall shape. But, like a lot of imperial Stoics, including Seneca, Marcus branches out to other philosophical traditions when he thinks there is wisdom or utility in alternative points of view. There are two thinkers that immediately stick out. The first is Heraclitus, and the second is Epicurus, with a healthy dolloping of Democritus going through Epicurean philosophy. Heraclitus's influence on Stoicism is pretty well attested to outside of the Meditations. The Stoic notion of the universe having a logos is thought to have been heavily influenced by Heraclitus's own ideas. However, the Heraclitean notion that Marcus draws from most of all is the famous idea of universal flux. That is, that all the things we think of as stable and give stable names to, both ordinary objects like tables and chairs, but also people who we assign permanent names, are all, in fact, undergoing constant change under the surface. Hence Heraclitus's famous expression, "You cannot step in the same river twice, for it is not the same river, and you are not the same man." Heraclitus may not have said these exact words, but they do get at this idea of flux in his thought. Aurelius alludes to this Heraclitean idea at many points in the Meditations. The most explicit comes in Book 4. "Always remember Heraclitus. The death of earth is the birth of water. The death of water is the birth of air. The death of air is fire, and back again." Although this is referencing a more specific part of Heraclitus's thought, Aurelius elsewhere uses the notion of change itself as a kind of philosophical balm, normally to put his stresses about everyday life in perspective. "Asia, Europe are mere nooks of the universe. Every ocean is a drop in the universe. Mount Athos, a spadeful of earth in the universe. The whole of present time is a pinprick of eternity. All things are tiny, quickly changed, evanescent." I'm certainly not suggesting that this usage of Heraclitus for Stoic ends was unprecedented or unique to Marcus. Epictetus encourages us to reflect on the impermanence of our belongings and our lives, and Seneca is also fond of drawing from Heraclitus, and it's possible that this is where Marcus Aurelius learnt to draw from Heraclitus himself. But Marcus places probably the most emphasis on the idea of constant change and flux out of any of the imperial Stoics, and at least in my opinion, some people may disagree, but I'd see it much more prominently in the Meditations. What Aurelius does, which I think is quite interesting, is incorporate this Heraclitean picture of constant change into overall Stoic cosmology. That is, he thinks that things are constantly changing, but also reassures himself that they are constantly changing in line with the goodwill of the universe. Aurelius is not simply a Stoic, or what I should say is, he doesn't feel the need to limit himself dogmatically to merely Stoic teachings. He does use other philosophies that he has read for his own ends and Stoic ends, in a way that I think makes him independently interesting to study as a thinker, especially because, as the Meditations are private writings, you can kind of see his thought process in action. Regardless of whether this was a habit that Marcus independently came up with, or whether he's taking his cue from other Imperial Stoics, or even the Hellenic Stoic Chrysippus, who also was fond of Heraclitus, I still think that this marks an interesting fact about the Meditations and an interesting thing to bear in mind when we're reading it. However, the more frequent allusions in the Meditations are to a historical rival of Stoicism, Epicureanism. Epicureanism differs from Stoicism in a number of key ways. Whereas Stoicism posited a broad will to the universe and held that things were destined in line with that will, the Epicureans were atomists, following the Greek philosopher Democritus, who Marcus also sometimes cites. Whereas Stoicism's primary ethical goals were the four virtues, the Epicureans were hedonists. They thought that the primary goal of human life was pleasure. That doesn't mean that they were hedonists in our modern, casual sense of the word. They were actually known for having a very moderate way of life, believing that this would allow them to rein in their desires and achieve a kind of inner tranquility known as ataraxia. Our modern caricature of Epicureanism is actually because of Diotimus, who forged a series of letters attempting to show that Epicurus himself was a disreputable character. He was actually executed for this. Either way, like Seneca, Marcus Aurelius repeatedly turns to the Epicurean worldview for aid in times of difficulty. However, I do think the manner in which he does this is really interesting. I'm going to draw largely from the essay by Gretchen Radam Schills in the Cambridge Companion, but this same point has been made by other scholars. It's one of the repeated themes of secondary scholarship around the Meditations. At many points in the Meditations, Marcus uses Epicureanism as an alternative to Stoicism, as a way of assuring himself that, regardless of which one is true, he should still find some kind of comfort philosophically. This is best illustrated with an example. Either a stew, an intricate web, and dispersal into atoms, or unity, order, and providence. Now, if the former, why do I even wish to spend my time in a world compounded at random and in like confusion? Dispersal will come on me whatever I do. But if the latter is true, I revere it. I stand firm. I take courage in that which directs all. This dispersal into atoms view comes from Epicurus and Epicureanism, while the providence view is quintessentially Stoic. Marcus's point is that, either way, his fear of death is misguided. I really like this aspect of the Meditations for a couple of reasons. The first is that I think it suggests Marcus may have had some doubt in Stoic teachings, however minor that might be. He is clearly not satisfied just with repeating Stoic ideas to himself in his journal. He also wants to consider what would be the case if Stoicism were false, and that there really was no direction or point to the universe. It also demonstrates that, for Marcus, philosophy is a means to comfort and instruction. Although his ideas are steeped in Stoic cosmology, he wants to know that his ethical foundations would be at least partially safe without them. But he's not merely employing a rhetorical flourish here. As Radam Schills points out, Marcus addresses a key difference between the Epicurean and Stoic worldviews as regards his ethical outcomes. Whereas Epicureanism promotes a kind of pleasant indifference at the world and its changes, Aurelius's version of Stoicism promotes definite joy. Rather than simply being untroubled, Marcus can actively rejoice in the knowledge that the universe is proceeding exactly as it desires, with him inherently benefiting as a part of that universe and that universal nature. And Marcus is quite willing to use techniques that he himself considers unphilosophic if they are helpful. Consider this passage on the fear of death. An unphilosophic but nonetheless effective help to putting death in its place is to run over the list of those who have clung long to life. What did they gain over the untimely dead? At any rate, they are all in their graves by now. This observation is not tied to a particular philosophical tradition, at least Marcus certainly doesn't consider it so, but it makes it into his notebook alongside those philosophical worldviews because he finds it personally helpful. And if we look at the first chapter of the Meditations, Marcus's wide knowledge and prudent usage of non-Stoic philosophies is actually quite unsurprising. While he ranks Stoicism, and particularly Epictetus, as his foremost philosophical influence, he also mentions a Platonist tutor named Alexander, as well as Socrates, and he thanks a tutor named Severus, who was a Peripatetic, that is, a follower of Aristotle. We also know from his letters that he was influenced by certain Sophist philosophers in his youth. When we think of Marcus Aurelius as a philosopher, we should bear in mind that he's not trying to assemble some grand, consistent system. He is assembling sorts of maxims and reminders on how to live. To that extent, his method, if we can attribute private writings with a definite method, would probably be closer to someone like La Rochefoucauld or Michel de Montaigne than Epictetus, though, of course, he is much closer to Epictetus in the contents of his beliefs. The point is that Marcus neither needs nor particularly seems to desire his Meditations to form a definite, coherent, argumentative whole. And so when we evaluate it as such, we are doing him a genuine disservice. We're judging the text by a criteria that Marcus would not recognize. And all of this kind of helps redress the idea that Marcus Aurelius was a kind of unthinking pupil of Stoicism. Not only does he slightly alter Stoic ideas in order to suit his particular situation and his particular needs, but he feels no need to limit himself to just Stoicism. He's borrowing from Heraclitus, Democritus, Epicurus, and Plato, as well as more subtle allusions to other thinkers like Empedocles, is evidence that he is not some unthinking brute, as is sometimes supposed. Marcus Aurelius may be much more interested in the practice of philosophy than in its theory, but this shouldn't make us think that he has no ideas of his own, nor that he is happy to simply go along with whatever the Stoics before him commanded. Even though he is firmly a Stoic thinker, like many others, if we go into his works with just this impression of him and nothing else, we might potentially miss some really quite interesting and valuable aspects to his thought in particular. But next, it might be tempting to consider Marcus Aurelius as a sort of perfect sage, a perfect Stoic at the head of a perfect Stoic empire. I want to question this characterization as well. If you want to help me make more videos like this, then please consider subscribing, either to the channel, or if you're feeling incredibly generous and want to gain access to exclusive content, including my slow motion book-by-book bookshelf tour, then consider subscribing to the Patreon, though it's absolutely no pressure. The links are in the description. 3. Marcus the Student. I've seen a number of people online really lay into Marcus Aurelius for not living up to his own Stoic values in a perfect way. And on the flip side, I've also seen a number of people argue that Marcus was a bona fide Stoic sage, a perfect emperor who always and unquestionably lived up to every one of his Stoic ideals and values. I think both of these pictures somewhat distort both Marcus and his writings in a couple of different ways. It'll become clear as the section goes on. First of all, Marcus never considers himself a sage or anything like that at any point in the Meditations. In fact, overall, he's pretty pessimistic of his own ability to enact and maintain a semblance of Stoic teaching in his everyday life. This comes out most clearly in a memorable passage at the beginning of Book 10. "My soul, will you ever be good, simple, individual, bare, brighter than the body that covers you? Will you ever taste the disposition to love and affection? Will you ever be complete and free of need, missing nothing, desiring nothing live or lifeless for the enjoyment of pleasure? Will you not convince yourself that all your experience comes from the gods, that all is well and all will be well for you, all that the gods see fit to give you now and hereafter, in the maintenance of that perfect being which is good and just and beautiful?" Now, I don't know about you, but this reads to me like a man deeply unconvinced that he's anything like a Stoic sage. I'm pretty sure that Marcus himself would be totally baffled to learn that he had any part of this reputation today. And indeed, we must remember that all of the exhortations in the Meditations are primarily to and for Marcus himself, one of the earliest proposed titles for the Meditations when it came forward for publication in the early modern period was to himself. And in some ways, I kind of wish that we had kept that, at least as a subtitle, because it reminds us that Marcus is not lecturing us, the reader, he is lecturing himself. So although Marcus clearly thinks it is better to not be affected by externals, to practice Stoic virtue and warm-heartedness, and to strive to become a kind of sage, the fact that he has written these things to himself suggests that he definitely knows he has not yet achieved this status. The fact that he has to repeat the same messages over and over again heavily suggests that he isn't learning them perfectly the first time around. In some ways, the Meditations is one big catalogue of Marcus's own imperfections. If he didn't struggle with something, then what would be the point of writing it down in the first place? This also has implications for how we view and judge Marcus's career as an emperor. As pointed out in that Wildberger essay we mentioned earlier, Marcus did many things that, at least on the face of it, were inconsistent with certain Stoic ideas. For example, in theory, Stoicism considered all people part of one cosmic community, united by their shared participation as rational beings, and so reflections of the rational logos of the universe. However, Marcus didn't do very much to challenge the existing institutions in the Roman Empire that, at least on their face, go quite drastically against this idea. Marcus has no issue waging war, and he also did little to nothing to challenge the existence of slavery in the empire. And these have sometimes been levelled at Marcus as evidence of hypocrisy or as deep personal faults that we should bear in mind when reading the Meditations. To which I think two things ought to be said. The first is that, like anyone, Marcus would probably have been prone to assuming that things in his society that have always existed were, practically speaking, unalterable. And the second is that he himself seems to recognize the compromising position his status as emperor puts him in. For instance, he says this in Book 9, "Do what nature requires at this moment. Don't hope for Plato's utopian republic, but be content with the smallest step forward and regard even that result as no mean achievement." Earlier in the Meditations, he talks about how someone could be virtuous and therefore fulfilled even in a palace, which does suggest that he thinks that on the face of it, a palace would be an impediment to virtue. And as Wildberger points out, Marcus often seems to view his position as an emperor as a real obstacle to what he really wants to do, and ultimately to his status as a Stoic. For one thing, he constantly complains about the people he has to deal with and the pushback he gets due to his position. This is evidenced by the sheer number of reminders that he has to be patient and kind with people that he views as fundamentally mistaken and foolish. He is troubled by the vicissitudes of praise and blame that his status as emperor subjects him to. It wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that at least a plurality of Marcus's troubles, at least as they are recorded in the Meditations, are social. So, at the very least, it seems like he is aware of the conflicts between ruling this empire and being so steeped in imperial politics as a result, and his personal and Stoic goals. Though I do think that you could also question this. I don't think it's a dead cert, but I also do think that Wilder raises some interesting points in this direction, though they're slightly more sophisticated than the ones that I've given here. And I think this whole framing of the Meditations as precise analysis of Marcus's own flaws really changes how we can see the work. As we said earlier, there is a tendency to compare Marcus Aurelius unfavorably to other Stoics, and also the Meditations as unfavorable when compared with more in-depth imperial Stoic texts like Epictetus's Discourses or even his shorter Enchiridion, which is a sort of nutshell distillation of Stoic principles. The charges are normally that the Meditations is shallow in its exploration of philosophy, that it's often repetitive, and that it doesn't give the reader much positive reason to adopt its principles. It's pretty short on argument. As John Sellers puts it, Marcus Aurelius is sometimes seen as the unthinking disciple who gets it wrong. I have some sympathy with these critiques, in that I probably wouldn't recommend the Meditations as the first book from the Stoics that you pick up if you're totally unfamiliar. But if you do already have a grounding in Stoic fundamentals, I think it's an exceptionally good book to read because it documents Marcus's struggle to live as a Stoic while holding down possibly one of the most stressful jobs in history. We must remember, after all, that amidst all that luxury, the extremely high assassination rate that existed for Roman emperors. And the high level of privacy of the Meditations as a piece of writing also means that we get an uncompromising, honest look at how Marcus did this, and more importantly, all the ways in which he struggled with it or fell short of it. There are other relatively private Stoic texts that we have access to, like Seneca's Letters to Lucilius, but that was at least written for one other person, and it's often thought that these letters were always intended to be read eventually by a wider audience. When Seneca and Epictetus write, they are writing from a place of authority. I'm not calling them arrogant. They are often very willing to admit their own faults as well. But nonetheless, most people are less guarded when they're simply writing in their own private journal, as opposed to when they are writing letters to others or writing explicit public lessons. So, sure, Marcus will be found wanting if we judge his book by the same criteria with which we would judge a full-on philosophical treatise in the case of the Discourses. But I just think this is a little bit unfair. It's judging a racehorse by its ability to do crosswords. And if we approach the Meditations in this way, I think that we will miss the more unique aspects of Marcus's writings, which are specifically how this one person applied Stoicism in practice. I know that I've spoken on this channel before about the use, or in my opinion, misuse of Stoicism as a kind of quick fix for your problems, a philosophical cure-all that will make your emotional woes simply burn away like so many Stoic world cycles. Simply read some Stoics, we're told, and you will feel better. I want to clarify that this attitude comes explicitly against the advice of many ancient Stoics themselves. For example, Epictetus's Discourses ends one of its many, many lessons with the following line. That's the kind of attitude you need to cultivate if you would be a philosopher. The sort of sentiments you should write down every day and put into practice. The emphasis here is on long-term cultivation and constant practice rather than on quick fixes. And while it's all well and good Epictetus just saying this to us, it is in Marcus Aurelius's writings that we see an actual example of this kind of diligent practice, and I think importantly, imperfect practice. I think this is why the idea of Marcus Aurelius as a sage or a near sage is so unhelpful. Not only does he never say that he is, but I think that a lot of what's so valuable about the Meditations comes from the fact that Marcus is so avowedly imperfect, and that he himself professes to not live up to the continual reminders that we find in his journals. Under this lens, supposed stylistic and philosophical flaws, like repetitions, become lessons embedded in the form and structure of the text. We can take away something about the nature of the kind of self-cultivation that Marcus embarked upon, that it is non-linear and that there will be many moments where the same lessons must be repeated to ourselves over and over again in the very way the book is composed. And I think that it's very much in the spirit of the Meditations, which so often roams the intellectual countryside looking for disparate and even sometimes admittedly unphilosophical tools for bringing Marcus closer in line with his ideal, to take such lessons from the Meditations. Although much of this video has been about exploring just a few of the overlooked aspects to Marcus's ideas, we shouldn't forget that Marcus Aurelius was not above using simple, seemingly unphilosophical observations to achieve his purposes. I've seen many people online saying that they want to be like Marcus Aurelius, but in attempting to imitate him, we don't need to necessarily inherit all of the contents of his ideas. I don't know what your personal view of the universe or philosophy or ethics happens to be, but the structural component of Marx's project, this functional striving again and again to develop his own character in line with his ideal, is something that can be transferred to almost any philosophical school. And I think that is important to recognize that alongside the philosophical content. And in that spirit, I want to spend the final section exploring this aspect of the meditations a little further. 4. Marcus and me and you. It is difficult to always know how to apply philosophical ideas to our actual practical lives. How often have you read something that at the time you felt would completely change your life, only for it to vanish pretty swiftly afterwards? Perhaps I'm just embarrassing myself here, but that happens for me at a near constant rate. The thing about philosophy is that while I do think it is incredibly relevant to our lives, it's not so in a way that forces our memory and our affects to seize on it and hold on to it. Even if an idea is extremely useful to us in the moment, we're not constantly being reminded of it throughout the day in a way that we are about just more straightforwardly practical skills that we rely on. You'll never catch me forgetting how to open Google Docs because I have to use it constantly as part of my work. But since forgetting the lessons that I've taken from the philosophers that I've read causes no immediate and direct friction with my practical environment, it's much easier for them to just drift out of my view if I'm not careful. Take a Stoic idea that I really do agree with, since it doesn't depend on their specific teleological worldview. Epictetus famously divides human action into the things that you can control, which are largely equated with your thoughts and actions, and the things that you cannot control, which is everything else. And then Epictetus argues that practically, you should surely only care about the things that you can control and resign yourself to the rest. Otherwise, you're just going to be stressed all the time. I really like this idea. It is easy to understand. It's eminently practical. And it seems like it should be relevant enough to my everyday life that I shouldn't forget it. And yet I do. I forget it almost every single day. I'm caught by surprise by some irritating intrusion from the external world, and I immediately let myself be carried away by it. If you'll permit a brief foray into my personal life, I am by nature pretty nervous, and rather frustratingly, this nervousness is always and has always been rather resistant to the persistent attempts I've made to philosophize it away. It often retreats for a little bit, but then it comes back with a vengeance the moment I lose sight of the immediate philosophy before my eyes. And the thing that I like about reading Marcus Aurelius is that I'm seeing someone else struggle with those same things. I can see him get frustrated with himself after failing to follow the idea that he has repeated to himself 1,000 times, and I can also see him endeavor to try again once more. It was a couple of months ago that reading the introduction to the Cambridge Companion convinced me that I had to read the Meditations again, that I had been unfair to it first time around, and that this was a work that had serious philosophical content and required serious attention. And as a sort of concurrent experiment, I decided that I would outline a few of my own philosophical principles that I find most nourishing and remind myself of them in my own journal each day. As far as experiments go, it was surprisingly successful. Reading the Meditations sort of alleviated the pressure I felt of grasping these principles completely and practically the first time around. It sort of de-shamed my constant failure to live up to them. There is this inherited idea that many of us have, that if we learn something once, then that thing should stick in our minds forever. The Meditations, I think, is a fantastic counterpoint to this. With that in mind, I have reminded myself of the same 3 or 4 things almost every day for a month and a half now, and it is actually something that I plan on continuing to do going forward, because despite the seeming simplicity of the habit, it's had a real impact on how I felt on a day-to-day basis. Though the line, "the soul becomes dyed with the color of its thoughts," has become a bit of a cliche to quote, I also think that it's a really interesting line, right? Because it bridges the gap between the explicit content of the Meditations and its unspoken but very evident purpose. These are the thoughts that Marcus wishes to have, and this is his instrument for dyeing them. And while I would definitely argue the Meditations cannot be reduced to a set of simple self-help cliches, it would nonetheless also be remiss to not recognize it as Marcus's continued attempt at self-cultivation. Though, as a final and perhaps needlessly contrarian observation, there is maybe a pessimistic lesson that can be drawn from Marcus's notebooks. If he still has to remind himself of the same lessons in the final book of the Meditations as in the first and the second, has he made much progress at all? I suppose to know, we would have to be in Marcus's head. Or, you know, try it out for ourselves. But either way, if you want to explore some more on Stoicism, I have a more general introduction right here. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.